let me introduce our first speaker today. Our first speaker is Seth Hart, and you can see his title right there, so I'm not going to read it. Seth is a grad student from the University of Oxford. And Seth, have you been to an ASA meeting before this?
It's my first one.
You're a first timer. You got the pink. So let's especially give Seth a hand. Don't mess with the recorder.
Just you.
It's set running. I'm not going to mess with it, but nobody else mess with it either. And I'm just going to
leave
it
there. Continuously through all the topics.
And you'll take it down at the
end
of the day.
Yep.
Perfect. All right. So, without further ado, Seth, take the stage.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming out. I'm not a scientist, nor do I pretend to be one, so I thank you all, most of you I know, are scientists for coming out to what will be a pretty philosophical, pretty theologically thick lecture. Now, I framed it a bit as a new design argument, but it's a bit of a misnomer because it's neither new, nor is it a design argument. But it is based on teleology. It's based on the work of Thomas Aquinas. And so I feel like when it comes to teleology, especially within biology, too much of the conversation has been wrapped up in the ID movement and the ID and whether or not we can disprove evolution with irreducible complexity and things of that nature. And that's the sort of teleological arguments you've heard from a biological perspective. Well, looking back about 800 years, we find perhaps the greatest Christian mind in history talking about teleology and using it as one of the ways to prove God's existence. And it had nothing to do with irreducible complexity, with anything of that sort, despite how Richard Dawkins might frame it in The God Delusion. So I just want to take us through a little bit of Thomas Aquinas' argument. But before I do, I want to define teleology, because I think it's got a bit of a broader meaning than we sometimes ascribe to it. But first, an illustration. Now, as you can tell, I did this myself. Now, as scientists, I know quite often you define things normally by their structure, their behavior, the process, something about it physically that you can observe. So for instance, like the definition of a planet, and I got this from the IAU 2006 definition, it's based on the structure. It's based on the orbit around the sun. It's based on the mass sufficient to sort of have a nearly circular shape, and it's cleared out the neighborhood around its own orbit. Right? It's a structure. Structure round to round a sun, and the orbit, the structure of the orbit, it's cleared out its orbit. Now that's great for science. When you're defining things, you use a structure, how it looks, in order to create discrete objects and define them in certain ways. But there's other objects that we don't define structurally. There's other objects we define teleologically. And to illustrate, I want you to imagine aliens. They come to Earth, and they arrive and they land, and the first thing, lo and behold, they discover is a toaster. Now, the great alien scientist grabs the toaster, takes it up to his ship, and he begins with his advanced technology to look into the toaster and discover everything about it. He discovers every atom, every molecule that makes up that toaster. Not only that, he discovers all the mechanisms, how it works, even its origin, how it was made, what factory it was made, what year it was made. An exhaustive knowledge of the toaster. And he's presenting this to his fellow alien scientists. And one of them finally raises his hand and goes, Professor, this is great, but what do you think the humans used it for? And as he goes, well, I think they used it to warm their hands in the cold of winter. Now, in that moment, you realize that though he had an exhaustive knowledge of the structure of that toaster, he does not know what a toaster is. Any person in here who does not know anything about my imaginary toaster actually knows more about that toaster, what the toaster is in its being, than the alien scientist, simply because they know the function, the purpose. So this is easy to make sense of when it comes to human artifacts, why we can define some things structurally in science, but other things we define teleologically by their function. That's what makes them what they are. That's easy for artifacts, but what about biology? In biology, we talk about what is a wing? Well, it's something that's used for flying. There's many different types of wings. An insect wing, a pteranodon's wing, and a bird's wing are very different structurally, and yet they're all wings because they serve the same function. Even a plane's wing, right? It's not biological at all, and yet we still call it a wing because of its functional trait. So, why is it okay in biology to use teleological language? And this is a question that scientists and philosophers have dealt with for quite a while. Now, for Thomas Aquinas, teleology very much interested him. He called it the cause of causes. If you know about Aristotle's four causes, for him, the final cause, the teleology, was the most important. And let me read you his most famous passage in his entire Summa Theologiae are his five ways. And this is his fifth way. The fifth way for proving the existence of God is taken from the governance of the world. We see that things which lack knowledge, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always, or nearly always, in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence it is plain that that they achieve their end not fortuitously, but designedly. Now I stop there because I think that's a bad translation. You go to the original Latin, it's more purposively. Not fortuitously, but purposively. There's a purpose behind it. Now whatever lacks knowledge cannot move towards an end, unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as an arrow is directed by an archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Now, as moderns as we all are, we read this and we immediately think intelligent design. I know I did the first time I read this, and I brought up Richard Dawkins in his book when he deals with Aquinas' five ways. He reads this and he says this is just William Paley's argument taken 600 years prior. But of course it's not, because he's assuming a certain kind of teleology that Aquinas was not. So I've decided to delineate them. I'll come back to this. There's three kinds of teleology. The first one is extrinsic teleology. It's the one we're most familiar with. It's like a toaster. That's when someone outside of an agent gives something a purpose. So I would actually say this is the closest to when we talk about ID theory, intelligent design theory. This is what we're thinking of. There's matter, and somehow one imposes upon it a purpose, like with the toaster, like with any artifacts that we have. It doesn't have a purpose until its intelligent agent comes along and gives it a purpose. Now that's not what Aquinas is talking about. Aquinas was an Aristotelian, and Aristotle was the second kind. He believed in intrinsic teleology. Now, what is that? Now, if you read Aristotle, you realize that Aristotle believed that teleology, the language of purpose, you can understand things having purpose simply by what they are. When you understand the form, is the language he used, borrowing from Plato, the form of a bird, you can understand, when you understand it as a whole, as a unit, you understand that all of its parts operate for the sake of the entire organism. It has its purpose in virtue of being part of a bird. So why do wings have a function? Well, because birds need to fly. And he simply left it there. Birds have a form, an intelligible form that we can understand. Their wholes, units, and every part of it functions in service for the sake of the whole. And that's what made these things wholes, is every part of them served the purpose of the single organism. Now that's called an intrinsic teleology. Now note there's no appeal to God there. Not at all. Though Aristotle did have a god, the unmoved mover, he did not appeal to it. Now, Aquinas was a bit different. Aquinas believed, having read from Plato, who was an extrinsic teleologist, and having read from Aristotle, who was an intrinsic teleology, he combined the two in what I call an infused teleology. Now, what Aquinas did, and this is a horrible overview, but it will have to suffice for now, is what he believed is that the form itself needed an explanation. So why is a bird the way it is? Why does it have the form? Why does it have a purpose? If we go back to his argument, he says things move toward an end. Now, whatever lacks knowledge cannot move toward an end. So he's still unconvinced that things, even though they have a form and we can make sense of them on their own, that wings are for flying simply by looking at a bird, he asks the question of where did the form itself come from? Now, to give an illustration of what I mean by that, imagine a builder building a house. Now, when you find the house, you can not have to know anything about the builder of the house to understand that this is a house, it's meant to be lived in and all this. But the form of the house, what the house is, existed in the mind of the builder prior to existing in the house. And that, for Aquinas, that's one way of understanding it. That, for Aquinas, is how he understood where forms arise from. They're mental. they're products of the mind. So they have to be something mental that is attributed to something prior to them being instantiated in the physical world. Another way of looking at this is some of you may be familiar with this distinction between existence and essence. So imagine a unicorn, you might, for one moment. You can describe a unicorn well. It has one horn. It's wrong to say a unicorn has two horns. And yet, even though you know the essence, the form of a unicorn, it doesn't exist. So there's a difference between its existence and its essence. So for Aquinas, he said, so we can have forms, right? But what gives them existence, right? And for him, that existence was given by existence itself, namely God, who was, for him, existence itself. Now, I know this is a flying overview of his theology, but for him, his teleology is much more complex. It's much more deep, and it's much more interesting, I find, than the intelligent design argument. And I think this is a way forward for assuming teleology, of actually producing an argument from teleology that doesn't appeal to ID theory, that doesn't refute evolution at all. And as I'll show, I think evolution itself assumes it. So here's the argument real briefly. If natural teleology exists, then God is the cause of its existence. Premise 2, natural teleology exists. So premise 3, therefore God is the cause of natural teleology. Now, I won't have enough time to go through both of these premises, but I'm going to focus on number 1 since it's a scientific room. This is the more interesting one, in my opinion. So let's ask the question, what is the status of teleological language, language of purpose? When you talk about wings are for flying, eyes are for seeing, hearts are for pumping blood, what's its status in biology? Well, post-Darwin, it was kind of in disrepute for about 50 years, until Ernst Mayr and Francisco Ayala were primary agents in bringing about a revival. Now, when you read the works of Francisco Ayala and Ernst Mayr, both are committed Aristotelians. Both love Aristotle. And both found the reductionistic tendencies in biology to be inadequate to account for what they saw as a very important aspect of biology, which is organs, traits, features have functions. They work to do something. You can understand every atom of a wing, but you won't understand its function for flying. You have to understand the whole bird. And they saw in Aristotle and some of the works of the scholastic philosophers like Aquinas a better way forward for biology. So this sparked a revival so hot that Mark Perelman in 2004 called it the hottest topic in the philosophy of science. I think Ernst Mayr measured that 18% of all conversations in the philosophy of science dealt with teleology in some way. And the arguments used in favor of keeping teleological explanations are as follows. They're useful in experimentation. They're useful in understanding adaptations in natural selection, evolution. And 3, they're important for understanding even the concepts that biology works on. So I'll briefly fly through this. The first one is experimentation. Simon Oliver in 2013 notes that the work of Francisco Varela on autopoiesis, which is a term he coined, which is that certain systems must be understood as functioning in union to achieve the same result, to achieve a certain result. So the token example is a cell, where all the processes together cannot be understood on their own. You have to understand each individual process as functioning towards the self-making, self-poiesis making of the cell itself. Now that's an interesting one, but the most important one is optimality modeling, which is still the most common method for understanding adaptations in biology. And what's done here, as I'm sure many of you understand, is that traits are assumed to serve a certain function, a certain goal and end. And if you assume that they are towards that, aimed toward a certain end, you can then map out how you think the trait will appear in the natural world. Now, lo and behold, if it matches how it works in the natural world, you have good evidence for thinking that has evolved to serve that certain function. So assuming that there are these things are serving real functions, that wings are for flying, you can map out an aerodynamic wing, go to the real world, and look and see whether or not the wing actually matches the model for what you think a good wing would do, which is flying. So it's useful in adaptations. Michael, if you're looking for more, the atheist Michael Ruse, the philosopher, is really big on why teleology is real based on this. The second The second reason is for natural selection itself. Now, this one's surprising because teleology is often framed as against the theory of evolution. But natural selection is based on survival of the fittest. And what is fitness except being adapted for, notice the language there, for an environmental niche? So fitness and adaptiveness is determined by selection. And what is selection selecting for, if not functions and traits that are better suited for a certain purpose that allows the organism to survive? Now, lest I be accused of a straw man in saying that evolution assumes some form of teleology, I'll point you to a guy named Hanke, who in 2004, he's a Cambridge biologist, who wrote an article called Teleology, Language That Bedevils Biology. Bedevils, and he chose that well. And he begins the article by saying, biology is sick. And he says, scientists continue to use teleological language, even though things really don't have any true function, right? And so I read this, and I was a bit appalled, and I showed this to my supervisor, Alistair McCrath, and he didn't believe me at first, so he pulled out the book, and he goes, my gosh, you're right. Because about halfway through the article, he says, he deals with the fact that evolution is based on survival of the fittest, right? Well, he says, well, fitness isn't real either. So what's evolution determined by? He says, well, it's just a survivor of the survivors. I propose that's tautological. That's not an explanation. That's not a mechanism. Natural selection loses its very power if it becomes a mere tautology. So I propose that if evolution is to maintain its very mechanism, it has to assume teleological realism, that teleology, that final causes, functions, are real. So finally, the very concepts of organism and species themselves. Now, I'll brush through this because it's impossible for me to sort of give this justice in the 2 or 3 minutes that I have left. Now, these are two, I call these the two core biological terms because, honestly, they just seem to be that way, right? Or an organism, right? That's the object of study in biology. But, as I've talked about earlier, the parts of an organism are defined functionally. When we talk about a fish heart, which has 2 chambers, a reptile heart, which has 3 chambers, and my heart, which has 4 chambers, they're very structurally different, and yet we call them the same organ because they serve the same function. Moreover, an organism itself is defined teleologically. How do we know an organism is an organism? It's because all the parts are working for the same sake, same purpose, which is the survival, the propagation of that certain organism. And finally, species themselves, we can group organisms based on their shared common essences. So there's certain teleological functions. We see them across the board, like wings that serve the purpose of flying. We see them across species. We see them across different organisms, and we can group them based on their common nature or their shared essence. And this is the concept of a species. Now, many biologists will know that the most common definition for species comes from Ernst Mayr and his populational model. And Brian Goodwin and Jerry Webster have I think, dealt a brutal critique of this, which is, first, it doesn't deal with asexual reproducing organisms. And number two, scientists quite often can discover holotypes. They discover new species. They don't have to know the origin of it to determine if 2 organisms are the same species. You don't have to know descent. So there's an epistemological problem there. Honestly, how scientists actually operate in the field is with this idea that species have a common essence. A common essence. Now, I found this a day ago. A professor of mine at Oxford posted this, which was an article which proposed ditching the very concept of species itself. The article is called, "What is a Species? The Most Important Concept in All Biology is a Complete Mystery." And it goes through all the models. It goes through Mayr's model, and it's a 26 different models, and finally it says none of them work. Know which one it didn't go through is the teleological model that I'm proposing. So let me give you a quote from Georg Taupfer, which I hope that's how you say his name. He says, "With this understanding of teleology in mind, it becomes possible to modify Theodor Dobzhansky's famous dictum, nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution, to nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of teleology. Evolution surely is necessary for the explanation of biological phenomena, but it is teleology that provides the very subject of biology." Now, I've got 2 minutes left, but there are attempts to try and get around this, to say, well, we can use teleological language, but what we really mean is something different. First one comes from Ernest Nagel, who was a positivist, and he says, well, what we mean is just when we say something is for a purpose, all we're meaning is it maintains a function, and if it maintains a process, it maintains a state, and if it isn't there, it wouldn't happen. Now, Peter Lipton has critiqued this, a fellow philosopher, says, it is as if the function of buses is to get people to work. We're equivalent to people cannot get to work without taking a bus unless they can get to work some other way. I butchered the statement, but that, yeah. So actually, the problem with Ernest Nagel, if I were to summarize it, is, yeah, it might maintain a certain state. A lot of teleological functions in organisms do, but it doesn't tell us why that state is being maintained, which is, it's helpful. It's for the sake of. So his explanation doesn't explain teleology, it just removes it and says, well, that's all we're doing. A more common method comes from Ruth Milligan and Karen Neander. And they say, well, when we say something is for a function, it's because it helped in survival. It helped in the ancestral population. It served the purpose of giving them reproductive fitness. Now, even in the way I've said it, you can hear that the language itself has teleological language in it. But interestingly, that would mean the first instance of any trait would always be non-functional. The first instance of a wing hasn't served to be reproductively fit for any creature yet, therefore it would be functionless. So that's an oddity. And what about, say, a human-created bird? It doesn't have an ancestry. It's never served it, but we would still say it has purpose. And there's interesting thought experiments from Alvin Plantinga, Alexander Proust, and Robert Koons, who show that this just simply can't work. Say, for instance, if there is an evil Nazi regime and they kill off everyone who isn't colorblind, for instance, would we then say, well, colorblindness helped in survival, but would we then say the proper function of eyes is being colorblind? No. So dealing with this problem, Robert Bigelow and John Pargeter say, well, if it would help. So they look, instead of looking to the past, they look to the future. So does a thumping heart now have a function is my question, because the thumping of hearts now could be used to diagnose certain kinds of disease, right? By listening to it, doctors can diagnose disease, so it gives a survival advantage, but we wouldn't say the thumping of hearts is its actual function. We would say it's for pumping blood. So that doesn't make sense. And I could keep going, but again, I'm about to run out of time. And also, I might point out that the certain thought experiments also run against this idea as well. So this has not been met with much favor. So to end it real briefly, none of these explanations that have garnered so much attention, as Mark Perlman called it, have gained much traction. And I propose that the only way forward is to look back at either an Aristotelian or a Thomistic framework. So I think I've proven premise two. But if you notice, I've left in Aristotle. So the next question is between an intrinsic teleology and an infused teleology, and I wish I had time to go through premise one, but sadly I don't. But I will say, if you want to bring it up in question time, I'm more than willing to talk about it.
Okay, I'm not a very good taskmaster. I let Seth go over a little bit, which means we have probably less time for questions. So as you have questions, keep them very crisp. And I will draw an end to it in about 5 minutes, and we'll have Larry Funk come up. So I see a question in the back.
I had the privilege of knowing Ernst Mayr shortly before he died. He lived in a retirement home down the street from where I live. But in studying him, I remember that he predicted certain things about species, what characteristics of species, which were later confirmed when DNA became developed, which is recent, and a lot before Thomas and even Mayr himself. Do you comment on how DNA evidence has confirmed a lot of Mayr's predictions about speciation?
No, I didn't comment a lot. I will say, since I'm running short on time, I will say this, that Mayr was a species realist, that he thought species were real against maybe the article I quoted earlier. And as evidence for that, he would talk about how scientists classified 38 species of birds in Papua New Guinea, which, lo and behold, when you go to the locals, guess how many species of birds they had classified? 38. If they were not real, then it'd be very difficult to sort of align how these coincidences occurred.
This was the next one.
Right now we live in a nice world where, you know, teleologically, organisms function in their environment. Now, how would your framework work if suddenly there was a disaster, like a volcano blew off and destroyed most of life on Earth, or another meteor hits like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs? It seems like when you have a catastrophe like that, that you created a totally new environment in which most of the species that existed, they've been wiped out, and what's left, you know, how are they going to adapt to this new living space?
Right, and I mean, you could make the same argument about a human in space, right? We have all these properly functioning things, but, you know, like breathing air, right? But of course, it doesn't function properly in space. So even when an organism enter a new environment, the question can arise. In which case, you say if something has a form and a shared essence between it, it also has a natural habitat that that's both to function within. So I would actually take teleology out further to a species level, to a global level, and even to the universal level, because I think there's a purpose for the universe. And so I think when you have this sort of intrinsic that we have a place, that we have a purpose, that we have, and we're designed for certain environments, with certain ends in mind, that you can make sense of that. And not only that, that's why you don't survive as well as you do, because you no longer can properly function towards your ends. That's what I would say to that.
The downside of our format is we don't have very much time for questions. I think we'll take one more. The upside is you get to talk to Seth whenever you want to during the rest of these meetings. So one more question.
Seth, so you said if natural teleology exists, it was created by God.
Yes.
And then one of the biological arguments for it was that it was natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a long stretch to say that maybe human nature to be selfish comes from a natural selection process over many years of time? And so is there some kind of long bow to be drawn that sin originates from God?
So I avoided evolutionary theodicy problems with this. Yeah. I mean, Sarah Coakley deals with a lot of this in her idea of game theory. And autopoiesis, Simon Oliver actually extend this out to game theory and how cooperative behavior can evolve naturally. But you also point out that selfishness as well, which I would answer theologically, which is whenever I think that God sort of revealed himself, he gave mankind a new end. And he changed our form and gave us the potential to no longer be selfish. And to me, I have a historical view of the fall event. What that looks like, I'm not even going to begin to speculate, but I do believe that we had the potentiality given to us in some moment, in some way, in some form, to rise above that, and that was supernatural. It's not something inherent within our nature. So, yeah.
Good coffee discussion.
Good coffee. Yeah.
Let's thank Seth again. A wonderful first appearance at the ASA meetings. Thank you, Seth.